We now move to the questions and answers part of this event. The staff at Zellerbach Hall was kind enough to pass on to all of you some cards. About 40 cards or so of questions were passed on to me. We received another 40 by email in the last week or so at the Middle East Center. Clearly, Professor Said will not be able to answer 80 questions. However, I did what I'm trained to do as an academic, particularly under pressure and with very little light, and I classified these questions into three types. The first actually deals mainly with issues of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The second deals with issues of scholarship and Professor Said's contribution to scholarship. And the third deals fundamentally with personal questions and his opinions about issues of identity. So I'm actually going to start with a few of the questions that we got. And I have to say that I'm going to present these questions in the same kind of raw language in which they were written. And I beg forgiveness from Professor Said for that. I'm talking to a professor of English literature here, so I have to watch my English. But this is not my English, unfortunately. This is the English of some members of the audience. A recent study suggested that the Arab world has made very little progress towards democracy in recent years, while other parts of the Third World particularly have become a lot more democratic. What are the prospects of democracy in the Arab world? What is it about Arab culture that seems so antagonistic to democracy?
Well, I think the last point is kind of, well, you say raw. I think it's kind of stupid. I don't think there's anything about any culture that commits it either to democracy or tyranny or anything else. As I said, cultures are made by people, and people can do everything. Had one
the question, say, 50 years ago in Europe, what is it about Europeans that makes them so bloody-minded? Or about Germans that makes them, you know, prone to genocide, for example? The question would have, you know, would have been dismissed after a bit as not the right way to ask it. But the fact is that there is, in various ways, a struggle in the Arab world involving democracy, which has been largely concealed from outside eyes. I think one has to accept as a premise, first of all, that all people want, as I said in my talk, want to live as freely as they can in traditions of their own and in governments of their own. The idea, for example, that can be brought in from the outside by an invading army, as presumably we're going to do in Iraq, is kind of ludicrous, because democracy comes as a result of, you might say, minute struggles by the micro-logic of people in struggles involving workers, involving women, and involving disadvantaged
minorities, who gain victory over time. I think there is a kind of melioristic perspective here. But I think in the specific case of the Arabs, if I might just make one important observation, a lot of people, especially amongst academics in this country who say that, you know, and I suppose in the Arab world, who say, you know, when or people like Naipaul who say, you know, it's the time has come to stop blaming others. We have to blame ourselves. I think that's a very false statement and a quite superficial. It has an appeal to people saying, well, these are your own self-inflicted wounds. In the case of the Arab world, I just want to draw attention to something, that the Arab world has never been free, at least in my lifetime and the lifetime of my parents and grandparents, has never been free of outside intervention of one kind or another. Imperialism is still alive and well. You don't have a military force of the size that the United States this very moment has in the middle of the Arab world and call it, you know, self-inflicted violence. It is imported from the outside. The same has happened in the Middle East. The same has happened in the Middle East since the early 20th century. There's been a struggle for democracy and independence that has been thwarted first by the British and the French, then by the Israelis and then the Americans, which is continuing every day and is created. Now, here we get to the self-incrimination. We get distorted societies. In the wave of independence politics that overtook the Arab world after World War II, when the rest of the world was being decolonized, it was being recolonized, the Arab world was. I mean, don't forget the Suez invasion of 1956, the establishment of Israel in 1948, the great number of military coups in countries like Syria and Egypt and Libya and Iraq and so on and so forth, which has all contributed to a distortion of human life, of which democracy is one of the great losses. So there is a very powerful outside argument for it, which suggests that democracy has always been thwarted. And indeed, one of the things that I've studied over time is how the antagonism of the United States to Arab nationalism, which continues to this very day, which is an expression of self-determination and democracy, has made for a very impoverishing dialectic and has allowed for, and the final point I want to make, for support of some of the most regressive dictatorships in the Arab world. Don't forget that only 20 years ago, Saddam Hussein was specially favored by this country, that the Taliban in Afghanistan were the freedom fighters that President Reagan called them, the founding fathers of Afghanistan, when he invited them to the White House in the 80s to fight the Soviets. You know, so this kind of thing has created a tremendously distorted situation. And I think, therefore, it's wrong to simply say that this is some innate fault of Arab culture or Islam as a religion, etc., because you can point to other moments in the history of the Arabs and of Islam in which a completely different situation obtained. So these are matters of historical evolution and, above all, of historical struggle. And what I want to say also is that the media, in its concentration on terrorism and violence, and as Pat Robertson and, you know, the televangelists and Graham, or was it Franklin Graham, and all the others concentrate on the evil of Islam and so on and so forth, they tend to obscure the picture of what I call this whole series of micro-struggles over voting rights, over privileges and rights for women, over rights for workers, over the right to certain kinds of social and political entitlements, which is taking place all over the Arab world. So I say, rather than use the snapshot approach and then generalize from that back to some evil civilization or religion, look at the dynamic presence and the dialectic and the difficulties which Arabs have to face every day, given this tremendous onslaught, largely caused by oil, not oranges, as I said earlier, which has made them the victims of this kind of intervention.
It's actually two questions merged in one. Given that a two-state solution looks logistically impossible, what do you see as a viable alternative? And do you really believe that a one-state, multi-ethnic, multi-religious is possible in Israel-Palestine?
I don't think it's possible now. I can't speak for Israelis, but my impression is that they want a state on their own, to practice their sense of Jewish identity on their own. And I know that Palestinians want the same thing. I mean, they want to have an independent national existence with land over which they have sovereignty, which they haven't got, and the land is getting less every day. And, you know, the settlements, as I said, have now taken up most of the land, and the policies of the present government, of the Sharon government, are anything but interested in Palestinian independence or two states or anything of the sort. But the facts are, unfortunately, quite different from that, or fortunately. There will be demographic parity in the land of historical Palestine by the end of this decade. There will be as many Jews as there are Arabs, or vice versa, many Arabs as there are Jews. They are more and more intertwined with each other. As I've said on other occasions, the history of Israel and the history of Palestine are inextricable from each other. And I don't think that the idea of building a wall or, you know, carving out little cantons for Palestinians to live in is going to work in the long run. There are too many popular pressures, there are too many interactions that have gone on for that kind of separation. Now, I'm not a political scientist, nor am I a visionary of some sort that can imagine schemes for resolving this deep political struggle. But I do think that education and understanding of the other, those things can operate on both sides. Of course, it's much harder for Palestinians. I mean, you can't tell a Palestinian farmer whose land is being bulldozed by the Israeli army to widen the road, things that I've seen many times in my travels in Palestine, you can't tell a Palestinian farmer, well, think about coexistence, think about the horrors of the Jewish past. You know, it'll all work. That's very difficult. But I think, why I told the story at the end, I think that a different model than just separation, which is, I think, much more utopian, to be honest with you, than finding a way to live in equality and coexistence, is. I mean, I think separation is the utopian and quite unrealistic scheme, because they do in fact live together, and therefore, I think equality ought to be the keynote of the future. Equality and self-determination for both people. There are two people in one land, which is very small, which cannot be realistically partitioned any more than you can build settlements with thousands of yards of electrical wire around them and expect people just to leave and go and pretend they're not there. So all I'm saying, using the model of the Andalusia and the Weimar that I talked about at the end, is can we not find more imaginative models for coexistence, given that these are two people who are tragically, but not necessarily only tragedy, involved hopelessly with each other for now and for the future.
I want to make sure that I get basically to all three types of questions, so I'm going to move on here. This question is about Orientalism as a discourse, as an academic discourse. Why has Orientalism had more of an impact on South Asian studies and on the South Asian context more than on Middle Eastern studies? In other words, Orientalism helped subaltern studies take off. Why didn't a similar movement take place in Middle Eastern studies?
I think it did. I mean, I think that the Middle Eastern, not being a practitioner of Middle Eastern studies myself, I can only talk about it from the outside, but if you look at the types of books that were written in the 60s and 70s, and the types of books that were written after Orientals came out, I mean, I don't want to, claim the credit for all this, but it, there was a seismic change, I think, in the attitude of younger scholars of the Middle East after Orientalism came out that is quite dramatic, I think. I mean, there's a much, for one thing, an actual involvement with the people of the Arab and Islamic world is now much more common among scholars than it was, say, in the generation of von Grunebaum and Goldziher and Bernard Lewis, who lives on, past every other generation, without changing, I should add. I mean, he's a... So I don't agree with that stipulation. I think there's been a quite extraordinary change in the social studies, in the humanities, where gender studies in what used to be called Oriental studies, where literary analysis of a kind that was never attempted by people, plus the sense, and the most important thing, is that the culture of the Middle East, for people who read and write about it in the academic setting, is a living thing. It used to be for, Orientalists, it used to be the dead cultures. What was much more important was, an 8th century Arab poem rather than a poem written by a living poet today. I think that's been completely changed. There's a very lively, for thousands of other reasons, the involvement of the world in the Middle East has become much greater, of course. But I think what's happened is that there's been a vivification of the field that is really quite dramatic and really quite as interesting and quite as deep-seated as that has taken place in South Asian studies.
Your autobiography eloquently describes the shaping of the identity of someone who is in important ways out of place in the world today. Being denied a homeland, Palestinians have an especially severe situation. But with increasing globalization and geographical mobility, are not more and more people in the world becoming out of place?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think that's true. But I think there remains, nevertheless, an attachment of people to their, in many cases, imagined backgrounds. I mean, the search for roots, the fact, for example, that so many people now in this country go to churches and synagogues and mosques and so on, has a lot more to do with the need for community and finding community than it does, I think, with religious dogma. So I think, you know, the rootlessness and the dispossession and the displacement is a fact of life, as, of course, people travel more and there are vast new migrant populations in places like Germany and Italy and even Sweden than there were, say, 25 years ago. It is a fact of life. But so also, I think, is the whole idea of trying to locate oneself nationally in all of this, and to find, you know, some kind of political and ethnic identity that that can live with others. I think that's the difference. The positive aspect of it is that that you can imagine an identity not in endless conflict with every other, but sort of amalgamated to others. And that's why I think the United States ought to be a much more attractive model than we seem to be for the rest of the world. But precisely because this is an immigrant society, and I think the idea of turning it into a Judeo-Christian kind of savage god of revenge, and we're going to right the world's injustices, and we're going to go to war, does a tremendous disservice to the reality of this country. But for Palestinians, what I've been trying to say about Palestine is that the struggle over Palestine and the struggle for Palestinian rights is not just about, you know, finding a place to go back to, which of course many refugees do want to do. That's perfectly understandable. It has a much more universal reach, I think, than that, and it's come to represent a struggle for a particular kind of recognition that has been denied it for many years, particularly in the setting, you might say, of sort of East versus West. I mean, because the Palestinians are an Arab outside people, precisely locked in combat with a people that had been precisely that kind of people before. I mean, the Jews used to be the model of the diasporic, exilic people, and now there, the two of them are locked in a kind of combat, which has attracted a great deal of attention. And for that reason, I think, there's a great deal at stake in that particular struggle, which is why I think it has the universality and appeal which it does.
I have time for two more questions. What can we, as ordinary American citizens, do to promote peace with justice for both Palestinians and Israelis?
Well, I think, first of all, is to have the courage to speak out. Everybody knows now. Everybody knows that we, as American citizens, are the suppliers and the guarantors of the Israeli war machine, which keeps things going as they are. And yet, in circles in which I live, you know, the academic and intellectual circles, it's great to be against the war in Iraq. I think it's important to be against the war in Iraq. But let's not forget that the war in Iraq is linked to Israel. And that the problem of Palestine and the distortions that have taken place in Middle East society, which have led to the emergence of a pathological leadership in Iraq, and to the rise of Islamic extremism, have very important roots in Palestine, in the struggle for Palestine, and the denial of rights to a people. Just because there were another people that said that their rights were more important. So I think speaking out is extremely important, that Palestine and Israel have been kept under wraps because you're afraid to offend people, because so many powerful people would maybe deny you a job or not publish your article. I think that has to go out. We have to talk openly about it, remembering that we have responsibilities as citizens for the money that we spend, you know, in Israel and in the Middle East, in the most profligate, and destructive ways, not only propping up undemocratic governments all over the place, but also in fighting wars that are tremendously costly and humanly impoverishing in the worst possible way. And lastly, I think we ought to also have an understanding that looking the other way and pretending that that's a problem, well, it's you know, those people have hated each other. I mean, you hear it all the time. It'll never be solved, not in our lifetime. These people have hated each other for generations. It goes back to time immemorial. That's simply not true. That is simply not true. All human conflict is created by humans, and it can be resolved by humans. And I think we have to feel ourselves as part of this.
This is the last question, and this is actually coming from one of our own PhD students. What advice would you give to the next generation of American scholars of the Middle East?
Well, I don't really know how. I think that the idea of scholarship, especially of the kind that involves living cultures, is difficult to maintain without a sense of engagement and commitment, but also of a certain kind of detachment and skepticism. I think in my own lifetime, I've been teaching now for almost 40 years, and of course fashions come and go, structuralism, post-structuralism, modernism, post-modernism, all that stuff, and right across, you know, in all the humanistic fields. I think what has always been in rare supply is a commitment to independence of judgment and mind, skepticism. You know, I mean, I never believed authorities; they're always the worst ones. And third, and most important, as I said, is an engagement in the ongoing social struggles, which one, as a student of the humanities or the social sciences, has to identify and take sides in. I'm not talking about, you know, the absence of objectivity. I'm not talking about, you know, just political ideology. I'm talking about human commitments, to commitments to justice, to truth, to fairness, to the end of discrimination and human abuse, I think. I mean, these are all involved very much, I think, in study. And above all, this is the last point I want to make, I think it is a special role of universities. I don't think universities are places where social and political problems can be solved. I've never believed that. I've never taught the Middle East in my own life. But I think they are an important place for the open and free discussion of ideas, and where controversy ought not to be, you know, shied away from. I think it's a very good thing to debate matters in a polarized and polemical way, so long as it's understood that it's still within the community of learning and investigation. But the idea of not listening to somebody because we don't like their ideas, or not having a speaker because he or she doesn't say the right thing, or not wanting to hear unpopular opinions, all of that, I think, is the worst thing for a university. And very often, our universities have been shy. Not Berkeley, but other universities.
Professor Said, thank you very much for your very graceful appearance here this morning.